by doing it. And then my dad is, so my dad's a janitor. He, you know, very hands-on guy, did all the car work at home, all the repair work. So the thing I learned from my dad is like, you know, to do like to build things, physical things with my hands. So to this day, you know, in our house, when something breaks, I actually love fixing it, whether it be the electrical box or some carpentry work. I have some drywall work that I'm working on right now. So it, I don't know if it translates to the world of business, but it certainly keeps me, you know, happy in my personal life.
That sounds like work ethic.
It's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about this world of innovation. You know, with a show named Innovation and Leadership, again, I have a lot of folks from this world on it. But there is such a lack of getting the water to the end of the road. Or like, you know, there's the executive offsite and people are all sure they're doing executive and somebody sent out an email about it across the company and we had an all hands meeting where somebody preached to the crowd about it. And then, you know, it just kind of comes to a real halt and everybody goes back to how it seems to be. Can you talk about the idea of helping a whole organization, like let everybody bring their brain to work?
So it stems from kind of two core principles. Number one is the person in the corner office or the people in that C-suite are not the only smart people in an organization. And they certainly don't know everything that's going on in an organization. So great ideas come from anywhere. But that's a difficult concept because the people in the C-suite have to give up a certain level of control and ego because a junior employee will come up with, you know, better ideas than them and they have to be okay with being wrong. And that happens to me at idea, you know, that happens to me at Idea Scale all the time where my ideas are sometimes bad ideas and they get overruled by junior people and I have to be comfortable with that. So that's number one. Number two is, in large complex organizations, if you have, you know, 5,000 people across multiple offices, even if you have an ethos that, hey, we want to get all the great ideas out there, it's actually difficult to collect them. You can't have people writing it on 3M post notes and mailing it around. You need some sort of technology to do it. And that's the problem we try and solve, saying, hey, once you have emotionally or strategically committed to building a more meritocratic idea-based culture that includes everyone around the organization, how do you actually do it in practice?
Yeah. What are some of the insights from being in this business all the time?
On the software side or specifically the innovation side?
Well,
sure. I think on the innovation side, it is interesting that everyone wants to have an innovative culture. I think very few organizations are willing to make the changes necessary to make their organization's culture or structure conducive to innovation. That is difficult for a variety of reasons. It's politics, culture, ego, physical office space, systems, etc. Number two, specific to the software side, software is hard. It is hard to build good software. And I think people underestimate, like, hey, if you and I want to do an Excel spreadsheet, it's very easy. We spend, you know, 4 minutes, put together an Excel spreadsheet, we can add numbers. You can't do that when you're building good software. There's a certain rigor and process and structure that needs to be applied that takes time to build good software. And I think people, I certainly, you know, this is my first job in the software industry, I certainly underestimated that stepping into this role.
Yeah. And you think about, when you think about helping people, like staff who are not in leadership, create habits of recognizing an opportunity and helping it get all the way up the food chain. And like, you know, I was listening to a little bit of one of the YouTube videos of New Channel from that great woman from BMNT. I just remember because we've had multiple people from BMNT on here and I'm a big T-Bill fan. And this concept that, like, good enough for government work, for instance, right? Like, I've had a whole bunch of DOD clients over the years in the Treasury Department, some law enforcement and state governments. And, like, there can be a lot of, like, low expectations because it's not like anybody's going to take their idea anyways, you know? And so there's a lack of reinforcement. There's a lack of acknowledgement that somebody was trying to do something special. And when you think about creating a culture creating a default position where it's like, not only are ideas welcome, like ideas are expected. We hope you come to work every day thinking about how to make it better. And we're going to give you back the signals to let you know we cared that you tried, even if we don't implement your thing. Can you talk about that concept?
Sure. I'll try and react to the back half of what you said first, which is trying to show people that their ideas matter. I think, at least as an organization, internally, idea skill is pretty good at doing that, because we show that whenever anybody's idea happens, doesn't matter. I have people in 6 countries with different levels of English competence, different levels of seniority. If they have a good idea, it gets done. And I'll give a very specific example. So I was running a big budget Google Ads campaign for our marketing department, personally under my purview. Literally, I'm the guy in there running it. One of my junior marketing employees, she came up with a LinkedIn advertising campaign that blew mine out of the water, right? Like, so what, within, once the data became clear, and it took a couple of weeks for the data to happen, literally within a couple of weeks, the CEO's program gets cut, axed very publicly, right? And I come out and say, hey, my program sucks. We're cutting it. We're shifting over to Lizzie's program. And that happens very publicly. And so that's, from our marketing personnel, the lady who came up with this idea, she gets a public recognition, but there's also a broader acknowledgement around the company that, hey, if the CEO's idea can get cut in favor of a junior employees, that means my idea matters no matter where in the world I sit, no matter what I look like, no matter what rank I have within the organization. And we reinforce that every day, within our engineering department. Good coding and good engineering practices matter. We're literally running a campaign, or what we're using our own tool to ask everyone in our engineering department, hey, how do we make our code base better? And our code base was written by our head engineer. So literally people are effectively criticizing something that he's done over the last 5 or 10 years. And that's okay, because we're looking to build the best product and we're coming from the best ideas. So that's the second half. I believe the first half of your question was, how do you get people to give their ideas in the first place? Is that correct?
Yeah. How do you get people who in their previous roles were never asked to do innovation? And today, it's like kind of a new thing to think like, hold on, I thought I was just here to do my job. Like people who maybe that's not the natural lens they're looking at life through, encouraging them to bring that lens to work and be constantly looking for efficiencies or innovations or upgrades and those kind of things. So
I think we do it via three ways: hard incentives, soft incentives, and company culture. Company culture is like that example in marketing I gave. They see it happening here that, hey, anybody's coming up with ideas and it's getting done. So that's the kind of soft culture element, which once you join, you hopefully pick it up in a couple of months that this is the way Idea Scale operates, and hopefully you're excited about that. The soft incentives are, we give a lot of free time to people. I believe Google once upon a time used to have your free day, like one day a week, you do whatever, you're not assigned official work. A lot of our employees actually don't have a lot of official duties. So that gives them a lot of free time to come up with cool ideas or to try new things out. And then finally, it's hard incentives. Basically, we reward, compensate, promote people based on how many cool, whether they're taking the initiative to come up with great ideas and getting them implemented. So if you're not doing that, yeah, you have a job, you have a place within the organization, but we reward people who are taking the initiative to come up with great ideas.
Can you give us some examples of hard rewards and soft rewards?
Say that again, please.
Can you give people some more examples of hard rewards and soft rewards?
Okay.
Incentives?
Sure. On the hard rewards, it's literally promotions and compensation. We just went through year-end evaluations for 2023. One of the dimensions that particularly anybody at the managerial level and up was looked at was, hey, were you actually coming up with things that to change about the company, right? Not, hey, are you doing your job, but literally, how did you derive incremental value? So I'm a finance guy by training, so it's like, how did you create incremental ROI for the company over the year? So if you want a $5 raise, you have to show me how you, over the last year, you created $15 more value for the organization than you did the prior year. And that's really hard to do if you did the same thing this year as you did last year, because then you created nothing. And so candidly, you get nothing incremental. But so that's a hard incentive. On the soft incentive, it's kind of, there's a culture of just bouncing back ideas here constantly. And if you're not coming up with ideas, you kind of feel sheepish. You're like, what am I doing here? Like, hey, I've got a lot of free time. I've got 40 or 60 hours of work, you know, available in my work week. I'm only officially doing like 20 hours of work. And if, you know, somebody's asking you, what else are you working on? You kind of feel sheepish that, hey, maybe I should be doing something else or coming up with other ideas.
Yeah. Well, and I think your appreciation thing and like publicly willing to cut your program and recognize someone else, you know, that's
and it's not me cutting my own idea. Like people will literally point to it's really funny. People will literally say, Nick, this is a bad idea. We shouldn't do it. And not only is that like not penalized, right? It's not like, hey, you got fired for calling the CEO that idea stupid. It's like, great. That is how a well-run organization runs because we want the best ideas, not Nick's ideas or John's ideas or Moinal's ideas.
Yeah. So I'm interested. I kind of want to switch gears, talk about being a turnaround CEO, you know?
Okay.
I've had a couple on the show in the past and it's, you know, it can be a different skill set. When you think about the principles of a turnaround, what are some of the most important ones to you?
Sure. I will. Let me just add that I did not envision myself, you know, 5 or 10 years becoming a turnaround CEO. I certainly wanted the, you know, the CEO title, the big chair at some point and somehow fall into this specialty. That's more by, you know, happenstance than design. So I think there's a few things that are necessary. Number one is there's businesses that have fundamentally broken business models and businesses that actually have good business models, but poor execution. If you want to be a turnaround CEO or turnaround executive, you want to look and identify and only select those opportunities where the business model itself is solid, but needs better operational execution. And I think IdeaScale was very much in that circumstance. It has great fundamental business model, we could execute better. Number two, you need your board or the owner's like unequivocal support because you're going to make a lot of changes very quickly. And you need really the support, the political or emotional support of the people above you. I'm very fortunate. IdeaScale is owned by one gentleman. He's very long-term oriented. And so he very much supported kind of a series of changes that I made over the first 6 or 9 months because even though they were dramatic changes for an organization that's been around 15 years. And number three is no matter how good you are, no matter how hard you work, you cannot do it yourself. So you need two or three people to buy into the vision and like roll up their sleeves and work their butts off, even in a rapidly changing environment. And I was very fortunate again that IdeaScale had a couple of those people who were willing to help me, you know, make the changes because they understood the vision that, hey, if we coming out of this, we're going to be a much stronger organization, which is, by the way, what happened here.
What did you not expect about turnarounds? What was surprising?
So I think there were probably two things that surprised me. Number one is it was actually reasonably easy to convince people what the plan was and get them to do it. So to do all the right steps, but to emotionally understand or to emotionally appreciate or identify with what the steps or changes, that was a lot harder. They would do it. They understood intellectually why stuff was changing, but actually to emotionally get, you know, I've been here about a year and a half now, and I think I'm, you know, I've only emotionally bought in about 50% of people, although everyone's doing the right steps. And that is still something that, you know, that is a priority for myself for the rest of 2024 that, hey, can I get the other 50% of senior leadership bought in emotionally to why we run a company a certain way? And then the second thing is, when you are initiating a turnaround or just in my view, running a business, getting good analytics in place fast was key. So when I joined IdeaScale, there were basically almost no analytics for really anything, how engineering is doing, how marketing is doing, how sales is doing. And getting those, getting analytics in place, even if they were imperfect, was absolutely critical and insanely difficult to do because when I joined, you know, I'll give a very silly example. Do you know what a DAU is or daily active user? Yeah. So when I joined software company, DAU is a core metric of any software company. When I joined, I asked, hey, what are our DAUs? No one had a clue because we had no data to track what our DAUs, which was mind blowing. And so we had to custom build that on the fly while we're trying to kind of turn this business around and grow it.
Yeah. So along similar lines, let's talk about the trucking company, right? As you think about, you know, not just execution, but getting people to emotionally buy in. And you talk about, let's talk about growing sales, growing revenues. What was a principle that helped you in that story?
Okay, I've got a great answer for this ROI. I'm a finance Wall Street guy. Everything is about inputs versus outputs. So if you're putting in $10, how do you get more than, you know, $10 out of the process? So for a sales and marketing program especially, but really this is the way our engineering is run, this is the way our HR is run, we very clearly instituted an ROI framework saying, hey, we're not a growth at any cost silly, you know, unicorn that rises and then quickly implodes the way a lot of, you know, organizations have. We want to have a solid business model, and that means every decision will be made on an ROI basis. So when we hired our first marketing hire last January, it was literally, okay, here's what the person's salary is going to be. Here's how many leads he or she's going to generate. Here's how that translates to incremental sales and customer lifetime value. That was an actual, incredibly mathematical discussion that me and one of the heads, the co-heads of sales had over the phone with the spreadsheet. And we did that for, we do that for literally every decision within sales and marketing. We recently expanded to South Africa, India, Spanish Latin America, and soon to be Brazil. And the reason we picked those four markets as opposed to the Middle East or Europe or certain other markets was literally based on that same analysis, saying, hey, where does the ROI make the most sense? What is the greatest probability of success? What are the numbers behind it?
Why do you think so many people in business don't measure like that? Like for me, the sport of business is like this, like, I think about it like an invention, like an engine, like, hey, how can we put, like, if we're going to put this much electricity in, how can we get more torque out the other side? Or how can we, if we want to maintain this level of torque, how can we do it putting even less electricity on the side? And why do you think so many folks fundamentally don't act like they're in the, like the sport they're playing is making money?
I think it's two things. Both come down to math. Number one, math is hard, right? And a lot of people never get the formal education or training they need. Number two is inherited bad practice. A lot of it, if you grow through your career, you learn by watching what your bosses and mentors do. And if your bosses and mentors are not using analytics, decision data to make good decisions, how are you going to learn that, right? If you are a junior marketing person, your marketing person is, your boss is making decisions based on clicks or impressions instead of the ROI on that marketing dollar, how are you going to learn? So I think those are the two biggest reasons, right? Like, did you actually develop the mathematical quantitative data analysis skill sets in your education or in your career? And number two, have you actually observed your mentors, teachers, bosses apply that in a business context for good decision-making? In fact, a lot of my time at IdeaScale, probably like 60 or 70% of it, is spent teaching literally the junior most personnel, the mid-level personnel, the senior personnel, who are all very well-intentioned, intelligent, high IQ people, how to do this. Because unfortunately, they never got that opportunity through no fault of their own, through their prior bosses, mentors.
Yeah, you know, as you're saying this, I'm thinking about like the parts of my business that I don't have good enough analytics on right now. And I'm thinking like, it's probably lazy CEOs where like the person who is the boss now that's measuring likes instead of money, right? Was probably raised that way over their business career. Right?
I agree.
Previous lazy CEOs were like, I don't know, you guys figure it out, right? And so the person who's the boss now was that junior person. And I should probably like have more compassion for it. And, like, that's how they got trained to do. They're just the boss now. So they're just doing what they were trained to do. And they're training the next people to do that. And it's almost like that lack of...
it's hard.
Like I'm thinking about myself, like the lack of discipline to make sure that all of my leaders are doing that and that they're having their people do that. And I'm busy. And so I justify the lack of discipline of like... And some of it is straight up triage, especially when you're building companies of like, there really is only one of you to go around. So when it comes to your senior people and there's only one of them to lead that, like sometimes it's a prioritization thing, but it's interesting to like, you know, point the thumb back at myself here.
Well, so look, again, my educational background was in math and physics. So I, you know, studied hardcore STEM and I used to teach and tutor, and it was just amazing how many people never got good kind of mathematical education and learned how to apply that, right? Where we obviously hear all the statistics of how bad STEM education is in the United States, but then you take that to the next level and say, hey, if people never got that that good education in the first place on how to think critically or quantitatively, and then they're asked to apply that in the real world, a skill that they are not themselves confident in the real world without any like teachings from there, it becomes really hard. It's very easy to fall into kind of not, I wouldn't call them even bad habits. It's like habits that you don't even know are bad because you've never seen it done right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm interested in one of the other principles of success that helped you get to the CEO level in your career.
Can you elaborate? Like, I didn't, yeah. Apologies, I didn't understand the question.
When you think about one of the core principles that you believe in that helped you become a CEO when so many other people went to Harvard and stuff never become a CEO, right? What do you think it is that's different about you? What's one of the principles that you feel like served you really well in addition here to the ROI calculation?
I think it was a greater desire, well, some amount of ambition, but also a greater desire to take risk. It's very easy to, you know, get a good corporate job and continue rising up the hierarchy in a well-known corporation, well-paid job where you get great benefits, you know where the career trajectory is. It's really difficult to say, hey, I'm going to step off my great job at Goldman Sachs or Google or General Mills, like these great companies where, you know, you have the next 20 years of your career planned out. And it's really difficult to get fired as long as you work your butt off and you get, you know, you're going to get paid a lot of money, have their fancy cocktail parties. It's really, you have to be willing to take a ton of risk and say, hey, I'm going to step off these well-known companies, step into an unknown situation, an unknown company, an unknown industry where for the first time, I'm going to be held totally accountable, right? If you are in a large company, you have a lot of support resource around you. And even if you screw up, things are probably going to be okay, right? Sitting here, if I screw up, I'm the one that the buck stops with me, right? Not only am I personally going to be affected and fired and destroy my career, but then also directly impacts, I have 100 employees who have 500 family members. So like, you have to A, be willing to take the risk and B, the responsibility of having the, you know, your own career and that of many other people on your conscience all the time. And that's, I think that's really difficult if you are, you know, just running through the corporate elevator in your life or career.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's interesting, such a judgment call, right? Where it's like, sometimes staying with the safe thing is the right thing right now. And sometimes it's like leaning towards the golden handcuffs, right? I'm interested how you would navigate that decision tree, right? Of the like taking the risk, leaving the fancy thing that, you know, your in-laws will be happy to brag to their friends about, right? For the like, you know, for the thing that's not guaranteed.
So my in-laws run a garden nonprofit in Vermont. They really don't care what I do for my career. I think it really depends. For me, the decision was reasonably easy because my goal in life is not just to make the most amount of money or to have a fancy job at a fancy company. I want to build something. And to do that, you have to, you know, I hate using the cheese line. You have to be willing to be in a position where you are going to make a difference. And for me, that's what gets me up in the morning. Hey, I have an opportunity to build a company and take idea scale from 100 employees to 200 to 1,000. Whereas I wouldn't have that opportunity if I stayed at XYZ large, you know, investment bank or corporation or General Mills or Nike or whatever. So for me, the calculus was reasonably easy because what gets me excited and emotionally happy and gives me that spiritual validation is building something, not having a fancy title or making a bunch of money. Those are all nice. Those are all, you know, motivators that I'm sure motivate other people in their careers, but they're really very kind of secondary or tertiary to my personal life decisions.
I want to go back to innovation. So you think about like giant companies or giant government agencies in the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, right? There's a lot of founders listening today or investment fund managers thinking about their portfolio companies that they would like to have those clients. When you think about attracting clients that are that type of scale, what's a principle that you think other CEOs might run around?
I think I'll say two things. Number one is it's very important to us that we build a good product. So the literal term I use in idea scales, I do not want to be selling snake oil. It's very easy to build a mediocre product and pump all your money into sales and marketing and try and sell it. If you want a sustainable business, I fundamentally believe that you need to have a really good product. So we actually spend an insane amount of time, money, effort trying to actually build a good product in terms of the bugs, the features, et cetera. If you look like empirically, if you look at, there's about 10 companies that do similar things as us. If you look at the number of headcount we have in engineering versus my peers, it's like, you know, the proportion is twice as much for us because I really want to build a good product. Number two is that you have to think about building a business over time. So we focus on the sales and marketing side, we focus a lot on customer lifetime value that, hey, I not only want, if I want to build a business over time, then not only do I need to win the customer, but I need to retain that customer so that next year I can keep that customer and add one more customer on top. And that is not only a good economic decision, but it also allows you to then obviously have a lot of references. So when I want to go win another government agency, I can say, hey, General X and X or have recommended us, or the, you know, the secretary of this agency recommended us. Or hey, if I'm trying to win, you know, Nike, I can say, hey, XYZ other clothing or apparel brand recommended us. That's really important to us. So, and you're seeing that in our strategy. So we're not, you know, pouring rocket fuel on a ill-defined fire or engine. We built a good engine, and then we are very carefully and incrementally driving growth. So our, you're seeing that in our performance, where in revenue or our growth went from like 6% to like 12 or 13%. Next year, it'll go to 20%. It's all incremental because we're building a business that is just going to continuously grow faster and faster and faster.
Yeah. And I know there's like, this is a very incomplete statement, but I read a little quote last week about millionaires focus on marketing and billionaires focus on product. And like, it's obviously not completely true. Steve Jobs was huge into marketing. You know, Phil Knight said that like Nike is basically a large marketing company that makes shoes. You know, like there's elements to it, but like, if Steve Jobs had done that good of marketing, but hadn't brought his A game on product, Apple wouldn't be Apple either, right?
Yeah, I don't, you know, yeah, I've never heard that quote before, but yes, like ultimately, if you, at some point, the quote I use internally is like, you can't fool somebody forever. At some point, if you're not building a good product, your customers will wake up. Now, you could make a decision that, hey, they're not going to wake up on my watch. I'll be gone and retired by then. I personally think that's a terrible way to build long-term value for everyone involved. But at IdeaScale, that's not the attitude we take. We very much say, like, I'm going to build a product. Like, I can literally tell you how many bugs my engineer team identified yesterday, my customers identified yesterday. How many CEOs of software companies, CEOs, can tell you how many bugs they had? And I don't do that as a bragging thing. I do it because I want zero bugs. I want, or if there's a bug, there better be a really good reason why we didn't catch it. And how do we avoid, you know, how do we learn from that tomorrow so there's fewer bugs tomorrow? That's really, really important for us here.
Yeah. It is this interesting thing. Like, it makes it another cliche of like, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can never fool all the people all the time. But hey,
and I'm not gonna, my business is not to fool people. I'm trying to sell you a legitimate product, and we work our butts off to do that here.
Yeah. And it's funny, is like, no CEO would say like, oh, I'm in the business of fooling, right? But I think we all know like, oh, this company of mine is nailing it, and or this product of ours is like, we're getting the job done, but we could be better. Like, we all have a sense of that.
Yeah, well, look where the CEO spends his or her time, and where they allocate the resource of the company. If the sales and marketing arm is 3x the product arm, that's probably where, you know, that's where their vision is, that, hey, we're a sales and marketing company with a small shoe company or with a small software company attached. We like to believe we're a software company with a small sales and marketing arm, which, yeah, at least by your headcount numbers and dollar allocation, certainly holds true.
Yeah. So AI has really captured the imagination of the entire world. You know, like, I did two other podcasts today, both about AI. And one of my favorite quotes was to, and I don't know if this is true, but it was interesting. It was, I said, a guy on who started out as a DARPA program. He's actually at the same cohort with the guy that invented Siri. There was a DARPA, and then, you know, I've spun up, you can't Siri at Apple, but And this is the founder of OneReach. And he said, you know, that somebody made the comparison of like, that what's happening with AI is similar to like the two other large events in human history of becoming the agrarian economy and then the industrialization of the world. And no, not the internet does not rise to that same level, but yes, AI does. And it's interesting to think about it on that scale. You know, we had this big conversation about agent training and the potential to build like a primarily autonomous company and have, you know, hundreds of digital workers or thousands of digital workers involved AI agents. And it's like, there's so much hype, but there's also like some real meat and potatoes in the world of AI. Let's start with this. I'm interested in how you say separate the difference as you lead the company as a CEO.
Separate the difference between what and what's in?
Between the AI hype and the stuff that can actually fundamentally be used today to grow the business.
Sure. IdeaScale was an aggressive adopter of generative AI almost, you know, weeks after it started launching. So before it became, the talk of the town on Bloomberg and MSNBC and stuff, we started aggressively using it in January 2023, which is like, what, 6 or 8 weeks after ChatGPT started coming out and well before businesses do. So aggressive believers and adopters in pretty much every department. And we have seen dramatic increases in productivity. And I'll give an example. So we have one gentleman who does SEO, search engine optimization for us. He's based in Bangladesh. We hired him, I think, February or January of last year. He aggressively uses ChatGPT for picking keywords that he wants to focus on, designing blog articles, SEO optimizing those articles, doing quantitative analysis, etc. When I visited our Bangladesh office about 4 or 5 months ago, I asked him, "Hey, how many people's work are you doing versus 3 or 4 years ago?" And he, with a straight face, told me he's doing the work of 5 to 10 people now, given kind of the technology he's using. So this is not a 20% increase or 50% increase. It's very much on the scale of the Industrial Revolution, where you're going from spinning a manual loom and wheel to weave to industrial machines, where you're getting a 10x improvement in human productivity in certain fields, or in certain fields of endeavor. Like many other technology companies, we're using co-pilots on our engineering arm. I think our early data shows somewhere between a 20 to 40% increase in productivity. And that's enormous that's incredible for an engineering team, because that would otherwise be truly a cottage or artisanal industry. So we are very much believers, kind of, I guess, believers in the hype, because we see the level of productivity we're achieving. Another kind of really practical example is many organizations have a social media marketing manager that is doing all their social media and posting and stuff. We have 0.1 FTEs dedicated to social media marketing. Last year, I was actually that 0.1 FTE. And if you look at our social media performance in terms of likes, engagements, leads, followers, last year, I gained twice as many followers as my next four competitors combined, with probably 1/10 or 1/50 of the total FTEs combined versus them. That is a mind-blowing level of productivity. So very much believers in the hype, because we see it, we live it. I'm constantly asking my team, how do we do more?
Let's dig into that. So
sure.
Give us some examples of some of the tools you use, some of the things you did in order to get that there with the social media.
Sure. So I'll use the social media one. Last year, my wife was working in Europe for her company for a couple of months, and I went to visit her, and I'm sitting in a bar in Amsterdam waiting for her to finish work so we can go out to meet some friends for dinner. I'm sitting at the hotel bar having a beer and ordered some pizza. And I call, you know, what am I doing? I pull up my laptop and just realize, hey, we don't have a social media presence. Okay. We have no marketing or we just hired our first marketing person. She's busy doing other things right now. We have no social media person. That's kind of silly for a B2B company. Let's see if I can do something here. So I pulled up ChatGPT, gave it a lot of context about, hey, here's who IdeaScale is, here's our voice, here's our goal, here's our target business, et cetera. You know, I don't know if you've trained ChatGPT or opened up its context window, but I spent a bunch of time doing that and said, okay, produce the social media map and schedule for the next 9 months. So it produced hundreds of curated social media posts for our organization, And then I scheduled them. So over the course of like an hour and a half waiting for my wife while having a pizza and a beer in a bar in Amsterdam, I did the next 9 months of social media work, which would normally be probably a person or a person and a half of full-time job. And I'm not by any, I'm a social media like novice. So if someone unskilled like me can achieve that level of productivity on their first shot, that is, you know, imagine what someone who is truly skilled can do, which obviously our more skilled personnel are leveraging that technology now in much the same way.
Yeah. And so, you know, thinking about the risk with, you know, AI hallucinations and things like this, how do you do your quality control?
Sure. So I think two things happen. Number one is we do suffer hallucinations. You have to be comfortable emotionally with some sort of error rate. I'm actually okay with that because human beings make errors, like crazy errors too, either because they were, you know, tired or because they actually didn't know what was going on. So the question is not whether AI hallucinates, it's whether AI will hallucinate more frequently or, you know, in a worse way than a human being will. That's number one, but we're actually comfortable with the fact that the human beings will AI will make errors. Number two is, you know, is the person actually, in terms of the quality, is the person who is using the tool actually appropriately trained to do so? In high school, I used to work as a carpenter, right? Using a hammer seems really simple, but there's a lot of people who can't use hammers effectively. So it's just, a hammer's a tool at the end of the day. ChatGPT is an incredibly powerful tool, incredibly powerful machine, not just ChatGPT, you know, pick your Midjourney, pick your Copilot, whatever, generative AI more broadly, Gemini from Google. Can you appropriately, have you given the people the appropriate training? So, you know, it's very easy for anyone to pull up ChatGPT and say, hey, give me, you know, 20 cat photos. That's easy. But does somebody know how to open up ChatGPT's contextual window in a way that appropriately trains it? So I actually spend a lot of time with my sales and marketing personnel, especially training them actually how to use ChatGPT to give it the appropriate context windows, to give it, to allow it to give you actual tangible outputs that you can use as part of your job. And that's like a huge part of getting people to get, you know, great quality outputs is training in the first place, how these tools work and what their strengths and weaknesses are.
It's interesting to think about that because it gets sold as being so easy, right? But yet every other technology has a learning curve. Why wouldn't we expect this one? Like,
yeah,
it has some pretty whiz-bang results out of the box. But like, mastery of any valuable skill takes time and meaningful repetitions outside the comfort zone. And, you know, why wouldn't this one, right?
Yeah, again, anybody can kind of use a hammer, but to use a hammer well, like a master carpenter, master woodworker would use, is probably very different than the way you or I would use a hammer.
Well, I'm specifically thinking about chainsaws. Like chainsaws, they feel very, you know, straightforward. Like you pull the lever, you push the button, you cut down the tree. But then you like watch YouTube of chainsaw accidents and you're like, oh, actually, yeah, you might want to know what you're doing, right?
And, no, 100%. Or the guys who do really cool carvings with chainsaws. It's like, I could not imagine myself doing that with, you know, ever. That's an inordinate amount of skill.
Yeah. But enough meaningful repetitions outside the comfort zone with the ideal coach and a feedback loop, you know, and, you know, you probably get pretty good.
Yeah. Right? You know, some of our people have gotten really, really good. And I'd like to think that, you know, in certain aspects of ChatGPT specifically, I'm like pretty close to a master, I'd like to believe.
Yeah. Well, listen, if people want to learn more about the business, they want to connect with you on social, where are the best places online?
Sure. So my IdeaSkills website is ideaskill.com. We maintain a very active LinkedIn presence as well. If you ever want to talk to us on the sales front, we have a big, you know, talk to sales button on our website. Would love if, you know, your organization's interested in us. For me personally, I'm very active on social media. You can find me on LinkedIn. My name is Nick Jain. And in general, it's very, you know, if you wanted to contact me personally, you could literally email me at nickjain@ideascale.com. I'm super accessible. Customers, junior, senior, prospects, consultants from all around the world email me all the time. And I am pretty good at responding to pretty much everybody who tries to reach out to me, as is the organization more broadly across, you know, any department.
Maybe as we kind of wind down here, what's one of the best pieces of business advice you ever received?
I think number one is that you can't, and we kind of talked about this earlier in the call, is you can't do it yourself. No matter how good you are, you could be, you know, the most brilliant, hardworking person, doesn't sleep at all. Ultimately, a business will outgrow your capacity at some point. It may not at 50 people, may not at 100 people, but at some point, you, no matter how good you are, the business will outgrow your capacity as an individual. So you need other people who are talented and understand the operations and vision of the business. Number two is math matters, right? Like a lot of business, and we kind of talked about this before, is one of my bosses when I was working in private equity was very good about pointing out like everything should be analyzed and quantified and metricized. And if it's not, like, we don't even know whether we're doing well. That's kind of like really terrifying. If you go to the gym, you'd like to see that you get better each day because you're lifting more weights, you're running faster. And a lot, if you don't know that in business, that's really terrifying. And number three, just practically at a personal level, like try and find a job, business, line of work where you have fun doing it. Because if you don't, at some point you're going to wake up and say like, hey, I'm not interested. You tell your boss you're sick that day and play hooky. I am very fortunate to be in a position where I love my job. I love this company. I love the opportunity the owners of this company have granted me. So I'm trying to follow the advice that I received over my career.
Awesome. Your enthusiasm is contagious. It's obvious.
Thank you so much.
Well, I think that's a wrap. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. And go check out IdeaScale.